From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater. Another hour of sounds from the Golden Age of Radio coming to you from New York's Finger Lakes region. I'm Jake Longwell. We'll open today's program with an episode of The Black Museum. This series starred Orson Welles. He not only hosted but also narrated the series. The series is based on different objects found within London's Black Museum. The museum was opened in 1875 and is the oldest museum in the world solely dedicated to displaying various crime-related objects. This series was aired both as a syndicated series and was also picked up by the Mutual Broadcasting System, both in 1952, and the series aired in Europe on Radio Luxembourg the following year, 1953. As such, we don't have specific dates for any of these broadcasts. They were undoubtedly used at different dates, depending on the station you listened to. We do know that this is program number 33 in the Black Museum series. It's entitled The Postcard.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum, a repository of death. Yes, here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a dictionary, a stenographer's notebook, a clothes hanger, all are touched by murder. Here's a postcard. It's a familiar object, slightly soiled in its passage through the mails. Usual cancellation over the stamp, an ordinary address, 29 St. Paul's Road, London. The message? Oh, yes. On the message side, a drawing, rather well done, of the rising sun.
Rather a conventional representation, isn't it, Sergeant?
Yes, sir. Conventional, still a rather unconventional matter.
Murder? Yes. Yes, it is unconventional. You know, Sergeant, I've often wondered why they held so many executions at sunrise. Why they end lives at the beginning of the day.
Anyway, that postcard today with the rising sun on it can be seen among the other exhibits in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Museum, starring Orson Welles.
And here we are, in the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. Yes, here lies death in a variety of forms, swift or slow, merciful or cruel. Death is here, laid out, remembered in detail, and perhaps waiting to strike again. Here's a typewriter. This is an instrument of death. Yes? Worthy of the Black Museum, definitely. The criminal care, the vicious planning that went into its use, till the person who received the letters written on this machine, in desperation, took her own life. Here's a child's toy, a tiny metal aeroplane. It's rusty in places. The propeller doesn't turn anymore, but there were fingerprints on this. They placed a killer at the scene of the crime, for which he was hanged. Now, here we are, the postcard. The postcard with its drawing of a rising sun. It's clear at once that a skilled hand drew this tiny picture. In this case, many things were clear almost at once, and conclusions were drawn. However, that, of course, is the story. The story which begins for us as Alfie Vine and his elderly mother turn into the entrance of 29 St. Paul's Road, London.
Alfie, I refuse to go a step further until you've told me what this is all about.
I'm surprising you, Mums. Oh, you've come all this way. Are you going to spoil it all now?
I'll not set foot in this house until you stop all this mystery.
Oh, Mums. Well, this is where I've got my rooms.
You're living here?
Well, 29 St. Paul's. You know the address.
It's rather dirty.
My place is all right. It's only the outside, and it's cheap.
Alfie, you've not wanted to show me this before.
I want to show you the girl who's waiting upstairs.
Alfie, you haven't gone and got married.
Not yet, Mums, but we're planning, so I want you to meet her.
All right, I'll go in.
They went in. The shabby young man, the rusty, black-clad, grey-haired woman. They climbed the stairs, one flight only one, but enough for Mrs. Vine to see the scabby walls, the dirty stair rail, the untidy hall. Alfie placed his key in the lock and turned it and opened the door. Light from the window revealed a single room, a washstand, a bed. The mother had reason to scream. There was a young lady on the bed, clad in the remnants of a nightgown. The gown, the sheets, the pillow were bloodstained. Why wouldn't they be? The young lady's head had been severed from her body. His mother, given into the care of a neighbor, Alfie Vine summoned the police. Shortly thereafter, he faced Inspector Wood and Sergeant Cross of the CID, Scotland Yard.
It's obvious, Vine, that this Alice Cortland was, more than a fiancée to you.
We was married. I didn't want my mother to think we'd gone and done it without her knowing, so we planned to do it over again after Mum's met her.
Yeah. Where were you last night, Vine?
Working. Oh, you can check. I'm a postal clerk, night shift.
Where?
Charing Cross substation.
Oh, check that, Sergeant.
Yes, sir, of course.
You work nights a lot, Vine?
It's a split schedule, Inspector. Two or three times, sometimes more a week. You don't think I'd done Alice in, do you?
We're not thinking anything yet. Not until we find out from the lab exactly when she died.
Poor Alice. She didn't have much of a life. Nothing to depend on till she met me.
What did she do at night while you were working?
I never asked. We trusted each other, we did.
I see. Sergeant, I want the neighborhood check.
The inspector was skeptical. You could hear it in his voice. The story was odd, to say the least. It became a trifle more odd when Sergeant Cross reported...
They knew her, all right. Every bar in the district, but not as Alice Vine. In most places, she was Daisy Cummins.
Inspector understood. Came as no surprise, therefore, when a frightened little man, a Marty Shaw, ship's cook on leave, turned up at the yard.
Yes, sir, I knew Daisy, but I wasn't with her Wednesday night. No, sir, not then.
When did you see her last?
That was Tuesday night, Inspector.
And before that?
Monday, and Sunday too, sir. We had dates, Daisy and me, whenever I was ashore. Always had a few drinks together, at the Ork, at the Rising Sun, places like that along St. Paul's Road.
Mm-hmm. But not Wednesday night?
No, sir. Not the night she got herself killed. No, sir.
Why not?
Well, she had a date with somebody else, sir.
Oh, how do you know?
Well, I saw him, sir. In the Rising Sun. I saw him.
Mm-hmm. Were you jealous?
No, sir. I was with Daisy's friend, Margie. Good looker, too.
Can you describe the man Daisy was with?
Well, I had a look at him. I believe I could.
Well, could you pick him out of a group?
Oh, I might, sir. I'd try for you, Inspector. I'd really try.
Apparently a step forward is about to be made in the case. The ship's cook gives his description.
Not very big. Slim-like, too. Shabby, but in a genteel kind of way. About 30 years old. Always doodling-like with a pencil. Kind of fella can always pick up a check.
A description. Not much to go on, but a start. Again, the canvases covered the area. And now the various barmaids and tavern keepers remembered a man like that, remembered seeing a man like that with Daisy, alias Alice, the girl who literally lost her head. However, there were no further traces of the man in question. Inspector Wood and Sergeant Cross went back to the bedroom in St. Paul's Road.
All right, Sergeant. With a fine tooth comb. The whole room down to the baseboards. And behind them, if necessary.
The detectives took the tawdry little room apart. The bed was dismantled, the window shades were unrolled, the washstand and its pipings were completely explored. The bureau was investigated, the drawers were pulled out, their contents tossed on the bed.
Hello. Here's something, Inspector.
Ah, postcard, I see. Postmarked the day before. Where was it?
Caught in the back of this drawer, between the backboard and the bottom.
Yeah, interesting. What do you make of that drawing, Sergeant?
It looks like the old Jap flag to me. I don't know of any Japanese eating place near here, Inspector. Dear Daisy, meet me at 8:15 at the... whatever the picture means.
It's a rising sun, isn't it, Sergeant?
And there is a rising sun. Where that Shaw fellow saw on Wednesday night.
Yeah, rather well drawn, almost a skilled hand.
An artist, maybe?
Maybe. Possibly the killer as well. Right, back to work, Sergeant. There may be a few more little messages like this.
They found two more, hidden in the recesses at the back of the bureau. And that was all.
It's 1,000 to 1 shot, Sergeant, but we'll try publishing these in the papers. Someone may recognize the handwriting or the sketches. More likely, the sketches.
And someone did.
Larry, this is May.
May, this is wonderful.
Is it, Larry?
Of course it is.
Then why haven't I heard from you in weeks?
After we had our quarrel, dear, I thought a certain beautiful model was pretty well through with a certain artist.
I should be.
But you're not.
Larry, have you seen today's newspapers?
No. Why?
It's quite simple. A girl you'd been sending postcards to was murdered Wednesday night.
How do you know I sent her cards?
They're in the paper with drawings. I know your style. Even in the paper.
I should be flattered, I guess.
I'm not. Larry, the police want to know who sent those cards.
May, will you believe me when I tell you I never killed anyone?
I believe you. I know you.
Then, for old time's sake, will you help me? I'm in trouble, May. Real trouble.
What would you want me to do, Harry?
If anyone asks you, anyone at all, will you say we were together from 10:30 on Wednesday night?
For how long?
An hour or so. Then you went to Earl's Court and I went to King's Cross. Will you?
Were you with her?
Does it matter, May?
No, not anymore, I suppose.
Then try to remember, May, please. 10:30, Earl's Court, King's Cross.
May Hester, artist model, once upon a time in love with an artist named Larry, and now asked to provide an alibi. In fact, asked to provide an alibi which might never be needed. May Hester lived with what she knew for a day or so, and then, half reluctantly, her feet and her conscience took her to an office in the old building on the Thames.
I understand your position, Miss Hester. I'm grateful you came to see me.
I don't believe he killed her, Inspector, but as long as you're looking for him, you won't be looking for the right person, will you?
Well, that's one way of saying it. Miss Hester.
Yes, Inspector?
I think you'd better give me his name.
It's Larry Duncan.
Mm-hmm. Do you know where he lives at present?
May Hester knew. She gave Inspector Wood an address on London's western edge. She left the environs of Scotland Yard. So did Inspector Wood, in company with Sergeant Cross.
Mr. Duncan?
Yes, I'm Duncan.
I'm Inspector Wood, CID. My credentials. This is Sergeant Cross.
Will you come in, gentlemen?
No, thank you. I'm afraid, Mr. Duncan, we have to ask you to come out with us. We need to ask you a few questions, and it'll be more convenient down at the yard.
Well, today, the postcard with a little picture of the rising sun on it is part of the exhibits in the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Now we continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Larry Duncan was held on suspicion of murder. The inspector was convinced of his guilt. Duncan protested his innocence. The family called in a famous defender, but despite the presence in the case of Sir John Cripps, Scotland Yard charged Larry Duncan with the murder of Alice Vine, alias Daisy Cummins, and preparations for the trial went forward. Sir John conferred with Larry.
How are you, my boy?
Fairly well, sir. Does my prison palace show as yet?
Not yet. I like your confidence, Larry.
I didn't kill the woman, sir.
However, you were seen with her that night. A man, a sailor, I believe, who had been with her the three nights previous, saw you both together in the rising sun.
That's why I asked May to say we'd been together after 10:30 that night.
Well, they have another witness, a tram conductor, who states he saw you leave that house at 5 in the morning.
He couldn't have seen me.
I take your word. But will a jury after that false alibi?
I'll have to take my chances on that, I guess.
Well, we'll see. Perhaps a little further investigation may bring a few more facts to light.
Sir John Cripps proceeded toward a few more facts. But he kept what he learned very quiet. Not until the trial itself did he reveal his strategy, nor the evidence he expected to produce. In fact, the first move came sometime after Inspector Wood and Sergeant Cross had placed the police case in the record. The tram conductor, one Charles Powers, was on the witness stand.
And are you certain, Mr. Powers, that the prisoner in the dock is the man you saw leaving 29 St. Paul's Road that morning?
I am that, sir. Positive.
How, Mr. Powers?
By his walk, sir. He has a kind of a free-swinging stride.
Thank you. You may cross-examine.
Thank you. Mr. Powers, let me refresh my memory. You have said the weather that tragic morning was drizzly.
Yeah, I did say so. It was.
Thank you. And that you saw the man quite clearly by the light of a lamppost.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And further, that you heard a church clock in the vicinity strike 5.
I did.
My lord, I offer in evidence as a rebuttal of this man's testimony the reports duly attested of the electric light company servicing that district, which contains the record that the street lights were extinguished that morning at 4:37 a.m., this man could not have seen anyone by the light of a street lamp.
Mark it for evidence.
And if it please the court, I have here the duly attested records of the London Weather Bureau. Not one drop of rain fell anywhere in London that morning.
Mark that for evidence.
Thank you, my lord.
A skilled lawyer in action is a fine thing to watch, isn't it? Here was a witness, an important witness, completely demolished. His facts called in question and his responsibility torn to pieces. The prosecution suffered from that, naturally. They attempted to regain their loss with Marty Shaw, the ship's cook.
In conclusion, Mr. Shaw, you identified the prisoner as the man who was with the victim the night of the murder?
I did, sir.
Thank you. You're a witness.
Thank you. Mr. Shaw, were you frightened when you heard of Miss Cummins' death?
No. Why should I be?
Why shouldn't you have been? After all, Mr. Shaw, by your own testimony, you spent Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday evenings with Miss Cummins. She was killed on Wednesday. Why shouldn't you have been frightened?
You mean because I was the next man to the prisoner?
Next man to the murderer, perhaps. Not next man to the prisoner.
Maybe I was.
You realized, didn't you, that your position might turn out to be unpleasant?
Yes, I guess I did.
And you discussed the matter with another lady friend of the deceased?
What if I did?
Nothing. Nothing at all. Except perhaps that from this woman you obtained a detailed description of a certain friend of Miss Cummins,
and from that description you picked out the prisoner at an identification parade? Well, Mr. Shaw, answer me. Speak up, Mr. Shaw. The judge and the jury want to hear your answer. So do I.
Yes, sir. I did that.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. That is all.
Another witness's testimony discredited, his motives called in question, the propriety of his identification more than called in question. The courtroom crowd was making bets as it filed out after the first day. The odds were swinging away from the prosecution and toward the young man who sat quietly in the prisoner's dock, sketching. After all, Larry Duncan was an artist. An artist wants to keep the record of his experiences, even when his life hangs in the balance. Next day, the prosecution called May Hester.
Miss Hester, how did you learn of this crime?
In the newspapers.
And how did you first connect the prisoner with it, in your mind?
Well, when I saw the postcard in the paper, the one with the drawing on it, it was Larry's, Mr. Duncan's tile. I recognized it.
What did you do?
I called him on the phone.
What happened?
He asked me to give him an alibi.
A false alibi?
Yes. He wanted me to say that I'd been with him that night.
And what did you do?
I agreed. Then I thought it over and I went to the police.
Very well, Miss Hester. Thank you. Cross-examine.
Miss Hester, why did you go to the police?
Well, I was afraid, I suppose.
Had you been in love with Mr. Duncan?
That is, yes.
Uh-huh. Was he in love with you?
I thought so.
Have you ever heard of an emotion called jealousy, Miss Hester?
It was over. I had no reason to be jealous.
I submit, Miss Hester, that when you thought it over, when you realized that Mr. Duncan had apparently gone to this woman after his protestations to you, that you were not afraid, that you were jealous enough to want revenge.
That's not so. That's not true.
You were afraid. Of what? That this man might try to murder you?
No, of course not. Larry, Mr. Duncan wouldn't hurt a fly.
Miss Hester, when Mr. Duncan asked you for the alibi, did you know the time of the murder?
No. No, sir.
When did you learn of it?
Here, in the medical testimony.
Did the question of the time of the death enter your mind when you went to the police?
No, of course not.
I ask you again, Miss Hester, can you say you were motivated only by fear and not by jealousy or revenge?
Yes, I was only afraid.
Afraid of what?
I was afraid that, well, even if he hadn't done it and I had to swear falsely, I might get into trouble myself.
And you were willing to sacrifice the reputation, perhaps even the life of the man you'd loved, because you were afraid to get into trouble.
Objection, my lord. Irrelevant, incompetent, and immaterial.
I withdraw the question. That is all, Miss Hester. Thank you very much.
Thereafter, the prosecution rested their case, or what was left of it. Sir John called Larry Duncan as his first witness for the defense. Testimony was short.
I didn't kill her. I left her at the rising sun that night, around midnight. I didn't kill her.
Nor could the Crown's prosecutor shake his statement. Next and last witness for the defense, one David Wallace, a ticket agent on a suburban railroad.
Mr. Wallace, what is your address?
26 St. Paul's Road.
What time did you leave your house the morning after this killing?
My regular time, sir. 5 minutes to 5.
Uh-huh. Did you see anyone that morning?
Yes, sir. A man going in the opposite direction.
Only one man?
Only one, sir.
Are you conscious that you have a rather free-swinging stride?
Oh, I do it on purpose, sir. It's good for you in the morning.
With the permission of the court, I request a small demonstration.
Proceed.
Step down a moment, Mr. Wallace, please.
Aye, sir.
Now then, just turn up the collar of your coat. Ah, thank you. Put on your hat, will you? Thank you. Now, will you walk, please, as you do in the mornings?
Chest out, breathe deep and all.
Please.
Like this, sir.
It was unmistakable, the free-swinging stride.
It was established that there was a man on proper, decent business walking in St. Paul's Road at 5 that morning. The prosecution had no cross-examination for Mr. Wallace. The Crown summed up. Sir John summed up. The judge's charge was brief and to the point.
In cases such as this, if there is any reasonable doubt in your minds, gentlemen of the jury, it is incumbent on you to give the prisoner the benefit of that doubt.
At 8:30 the same evening, the jury filed back into the box. The clerk solemnly intoned the old question. Have you reached a verdict?
We have.
Again the clerk spoke. What is your verdict?
We find the accused not guilty.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
Today, that postcard, whatever it may mean with its rising sun, reposes in a place of honor in the Black Museum.
The Black Museum on the Upstate Radio Theater. Orson Welles, our star. Episode number 33 in that series from 1952. It was entitled The Postcard. You are listening to the Upstate Radio Theater from Quality Radio Productions. I'm your host, Jake Longwell, presenting the very best of old-time radio for your listening pleasure. If you want to get in touch with the program, you can do so by email. I'd love to hear from you. Your feedback about the show is very important. Please let me know what some of your favorite old-time radio shows are, and I'll try to accommodate your requests on future radio theater broadcasts. The email address to use is qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And if you'd like more information about the radio theater, such as detailed playlists, or if you'd like to stream this and previous episodes in the series at your convenience, well, then you'll want to head over to our blog and website at qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. This is Upstate Radio Theater show number 1608. We'll turn to some comedy to wrap up this hour of old-time radio, as we turn to Burns and Allen. Of course, I'm referring to the husband and wife team of George Burns and Gracie Allen. They began entertaining American audiences on vaudeville before making their way to radio, and eventually film and television, keeping us laughing for decades to come. This broadcast is from during the World War II era, and it's an NBC broadcast from February 2nd of 1943. It's entitled, Good Help is Hard to Find.
Well, hello. Come right in. Oh, George, we've got company.
This is Bill Goodwin speaking for Lever Brothers, makers of Swan, the new white floating soap. Well, it's Tuesday night again. Time for another pleasant visit with George Burns and Gracie Allen, Jimmy Cash and Paul Whiteman and his music. But first, here are the six hits and a miss, singing Hip Hip Hooray.
Hip Hip Hooray, we're living in the USA. Come on, you Yanks, go holler things. Hip Hip Hooray. Hip, hip, hooray. Americans will always say, we like it here, stand up and cheer. Hooray, hooray. Every girl and boy can find romance beneath star-spangled skies. There's lots of fun for everyone in our land.
Now meet the people who live in the Burns house, George and Gracie. Well, it's early morning at the Burns home, and all three of the Burnses are still sound asleep. There's Papa Burns. And Baby Burns. And Mama Burns.
Oh, Tyrone, do you really think so?
Huh? What? What?
Oh. Gosh, it's cold. Every morning since our mate quit, it's the same thing. Get up in a cold house and go fix the furnace. Oh, well, somebody has to do it. Gracie, wake up. It's time for you to fix the furnace.
Good morning, George. Herbert, wake up there. It's morning. Oh. Good morning, darling. Now say good morning to your daddy.
Gee, he's cute. I could just eat him up. In fact, I think I'm going to eat him.
That's no way to talk.
All right. Well, you better get up and fix the furnace, Dave.
Oh, I don't have to this morning. We have a maid to do that.
A maid? You mean Minnie is back?
Oh, no.
I thought maybe Lockie dropped her option. Imagine having a maid again.
Oh, yes. Isn't it wonderful? We're going to have breakfast in bed this morning.
Really?
Yes. You know, when I was a girl, I went to a hospital once for 3 weeks just so I could have breakfast in bed every morning.
And you weren't sick?
No, but I kept insisting I had a pain in my side. And did the doctors fall for it? Imagine, they even took out my appendix.
And you sure put one over on them.
Yeah, I know. Well, ring for the maid, dear. The bell's right alongside your bed.
Okay. Okay. I can't believe we finally got a maid.
You'll be surprised when you see her. Oh, good morning, Tootsie.
Oh, did Madam ring?
Oh, no. Don't tell me Tootsie Sagwell is the maid.
Sure. Is breakfast ready, Tootsie?
Uh-huh. I'll bring it up as soon as the coffee cools off.
As soon as it cools off?
Yes. Those tin cans get so hot you can't pick them up off the stove.
All right, Gracie. You better explain why Tootsie is in this house pretending to be a maid.
Well, it's part of our plan, George.
What plan?
The Beverly Hills Uplift Society give each other a boost in the crisis plan.
Might have known that silly club of yours was involved.
Well, it's a marvelous idea.
I'll bet.
Well, you know it's almost impossible to get help now. So the members are going to take turns being each other's servants.
Only a genius could think up an idea like that.
Oh, please, Judge, you're making me blush.
Oh, I say.
Now, take our laundry arrangement. I do Mrs. Taylor's laundry at her house, and she does mine here.
Well, that saves you both a lot of work.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is carry our washing machine back and forth.
That's all I have to do?
Sure. She doesn't live so far from us. And it's all downhill all the way to her house.
And uphill all the way back.
You never made the trip, George. You're just guessing.
Yeah. I'm just guessing.
Madame. And shall I place it on the table?
Hey, look out for that footstool.
Oh. I think I tripped.
Oh. Well, don't feel bad, Tootsie. I asked for breakfast in bed, and that's where you put most of it.
Look at this mess. Coffee, eggs, butter, bacon in our bed.
Yeah, aren't we lucky? Most people haven't even got it in their icebox.
Yeah, we're very lucky.
I'm sorry, Gracie. I didn't mean to do it.
All right. Stop cackling, even if you are the only hen who ever laid a fried egg on a blanket.
Well, never mind, Tootsie. Just go down and start all over again.
She'll do nothing of the kind.
If you want to cook that badly, I'll hire one.
But, George, if you do that, what will happen to the Beverly Hills Uplift Society give each other a boost in the crisis plan?
Just clean up this mess. I'm going down and get a cook. Tomato juice all over my pajamas. Wish that Tootsie Sagra would get drafted. But I guess her face will always be in 4F.
Hi, George.
Oh, good morning, Bill.
I just dropped by to... Say, you certainly like to brag, don't you?
I like to brag?
Yeah, I know bacon is hard to get, but do you have to wear a slice behind your ear?
Just had my breakfast thrown at me. Do you know a good employment agency? I want to hire a cook.
Well, George, I know the girl at the newspaper office who takes the help wanted ads. I'll give her a ring, huh?
Oh, don't bother, Bill. I'll just call a nation
station. Oh, it's no bother, George. She loves to have me call her. In fact, Barbara's so crazy about me, she'll probably put the ad in for nothing.
Oh, good.
Hello. Oh, hello, Babs. This is Billy. Take this ad, will you? Billy. Yeah, Bill. Oh, you know Bill Goodwin. Look, who's got dimples and curly hair and kissed you last night, huh? What? About 9:30. Oh, he did? Well, maybe I was there at 9:15.
Look, Dimples, just give her the ad. Maid wanted, good salary.
Oh, you remember me, Babs. We had a wonderful conversation. You said, what's new? And I said, Swan soap. And you said, what do you know? And I said, I know Swan is purer than the finest Castiles. Money can't buy a purer soap. And you said, get him. Gee, it was such a romantic conversation.
Just give her the ad, Lockenbaum. Maid wanted, easy hours.
Well, gee, Babs, don't you remember? I said Swan is great for washing the dishes because it suds faster than other white floating soaps. And since Swan is purer than the finest Castiles, it's kind to your hands, too. Helps keep them soft and lovely. So use Swan for every soap and water job in the house. And you said, uh-huh. Babs, don't you remember saying, uh-huh?
Bill, I'd like to hire a maid. Would you tell her that it's...
Oh, Babs, don't you remember how I took your little hand in mine and showed you how to break Swan in two with a simple twist of the wrist?
Look, Bill.
So that you could use half in the kitchen for your dishes and cleaning and the other half in the bathroom for your hands and face? Remember? Oh, you do?
Well, good. Bill, now give her the ad.
Well, I'll be right over, sweetheart. Goodbye.
Bill, you called that girl for me.
Are you kidding?
Well, I'll get her, cook. Where's the phone book?
George, what are you doing?
Looking up an employment agency.
Well, you might as well use the club plan. You'll never be able to get a cook.
Well, don't worry. I'll get one.
I'll bet you won't.
Well, all right. It's a bet. You know that expensive hat I wouldn't let you buy?
Yes.
I'll bet you that hat.
All right.
All right.
And if I lose, you can go up and get it out of my closet and take it back.
This is Paul White, and the boys and I would like to pay a little tribute to a good neighbor with our arrangement of Brazil.
Gracie, you said it was impossible to hire any help. But just look in the other room. There are four or five women waiting to be interviewed.
Well, George, you're making a big mistake. You ought to use our Beverly Hills Uplift Society to give each other a boost in the crisis plan.
Gracie, I don't want to hear any more
about
it.
Well, it's a wonderful plan, George. They boost you today, and you boost them tomorrow.
I can't wait till tomorrow. I'd like to boost them right
George.
Out. Well, forget the plan, Gracie. Forget the club plan. I'll show you how to handle the help situation. Okay, I'll see the first applicant. Now, madam, I'm going to be businesslike about this and not waste any time. The pay is $20 a week and you get Thursdays off, and there's no use asking any questions because that covers everything. Do you want the job?
No.
Gee.
She was businesslike too, wasn't she?
Yeah, I guess I frightened the poor woman.
Say, George, I have a wonderful idea.
What?
Why not adopt the Beverly Hills Uplift Society?
No. I don't want those club women in this house. I'd rather have termites.
Well, George, this is no time to be choosy.
Well, forget it. I'm going to interview the next woman.
Right
this way. Who's next?
I am.
Now, miss...
Let's get going, Shorty. I ain't got all day. What's your name?
Huh?
Your name. If I cut my finger, I want to know who I'm suing.
Oh, fine.
Oh, his name is Mr. George Burns.
Burns is enough. I ain't going to call him Mr. because I'm as good as he is.
Yeah, but...
And I ain't going to call you George because you ain't my type.
Yeah, but...
So Burns is enough.
Yeah.
How many rooms in this house, Burns?
Well... There are four rooms upstairs.
Never mind the upstairs. I'm strictly a downstairs cleaner.
Well, downstairs is the library and the living room.
Well, bring the books in the living room. That makes one less to clean. What else?
Well, there's a dining room and a kitchen.
We'll eat in the kitchen. That makes two less.
Now, wait a minute.
Better bring the books in the kitchen, too. Why spread out?
Now, wait a minute.
What does this job pay?
20 a week.
20 a week? I pay my cook more than that.
All right. What's so funny? What are you laughing at?
You frightened that poor woman, too. Oh, George, if you'd only adopt...
Gracie, I don't want those silly club women in this house.
But, George, they only want to help you. And you know what I always say? Love laughs at locksmiths.
Well, what is that? That proverb doesn't fit.
Well, maybe not, but that's what I always say.
Yeah, and I always have to listen to it. Next girl.
You mean me?
Yeah, step in here. How do you do?
Hello.
Are you an experienced cook?
Oh, sure. I've had 10 jobs in the last month.
Well, why did you leave all those positions?
I didn't leave. They fired me.
Well, wasn't your work satisfactory?
Oh, sure.
Well, then, why did they fire you?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Well, I have, and good day.
Well, George, shall we try the club plan, dear?
Oh. Honey, for the last time, I'm not going to do anybody else's housework.
But you know all the people in the club, George. It's not like I was asking you to scrub a strange floor or wash a sock off an unfamiliar foot.
Forget it. Anyway, there's still one dame left. I better handle her with kid gloves. Well, hello there. I guess you're the last one.
I guess I am.
Well, step right in. You know what they say. Last but not least. This is my wife.
I'm sure you'll find me satisfactory, madam. I'm an excellent all-round worker.
Well, the work is very simple. In the morning, you dust the...
No dusting.
No dusting?
Dust is bad for my sinuses.
Well, my wife will be glad to do the dusting.
And the laundry.
No laundry?
I'm allergic to water.
Well, don't you ever wash yourself?
Oh, sure. With olive oil.
Well, maybe she can do the laundry in olive oil.
Gracie, if you don't...
Well, it would make it easy if you had to slip into your clothes. Mm.
Very hilarious. Look, miss, do you mind sweeping?
Oh, no. Sweep as much as you like.
No sweeping?
Rheumatism.
Well, can you cook?
Oh, I'm a wonderful cook.
But?
The smell of food makes me bilious.
Lady, is there anything wrong with your legs?
No, my legs are fine.
Then run out the door. Out! Out!
Well, George, you give up?
No.
Well, George, why don't you let me handle the servant problem? My mother always said that the wife should run the home and the husband should earn the money.
Well, in this family, the husband runs the house.
Poor Mama. She had the whole thing backwards.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Here's Jimmy Cash with a mighty attractive proposition. Why don't you fall in love with me? And okay, Jimmy.
I'm tired of feeling blue. I want to know just how I stand with you. And now that you're in my embrace, this is the time, this is the place. As long as you're not in love with anyone else, why don't you fall in love? You're driving me crazy, baby, trying to guess. Will you tell me no or will you tell me yes? You gotta go overboard for someone someday. Believe it or not, it's bound to be. As long as you're not in love with anyone else, why don't you fall in love with me?
Well, now George is out making the rounds of the employment agencies. Meanwhile, Gracie has slipped Tootsie into the kitchen as their cook. She feels confident that when George tastes the Irish stew they're making, he'll okay her club plan.
How's the stew coming along, Tootsie? Almost done?
I think so, Gracie. Oh, the potatoes and onions look lovely.
Let's see. They do look nice. Which is which?
The potatoes are the ones that fell apart.
Oh.
Oh, it's too bad we didn't have any carrots.
Oh, well, that doesn't matter. The bananas we put in are practically the same shape.
Oh, that's right. And with the skins left on, they're almost the same color.
Sure, sure. George will never know the difference. I just know our stew will be a big success, Tootsie. Even if we did have to make it without meat.
Oh, yeah, it's lucky you thought of that article you read about meat substitutes.
Oh, it certainly is. Do you think that pound of Swiss cheese will be enough? Or should we put in the Roquefort, too?
Oh, I think the Swiss cheese is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Hiya, Gracie. I saw you and George through the kitchen window. Oh, Tootsie, I thought you were George with an apron on.
That's not a very nice thing to say, Bill.
Oh, you're right. He's one of my very dearest friends.
Gee, I'm sorry you didn't hire a new cook, Gracie, because I wanted to tell her about Swan, the new white floating soap that's purer than the finest Castiles. I wanted to tell her that Swan's a regular suds and whiz.
Well, Tootsie's our cook today, Bill. You see, we have a club plan where we all work for one another.
Oh, say, that sounds like a swell idea. Can I get in on it?
Oh, sure. You can come over to my house tomorrow and cook for me.
I've
always wanted to stir up something with you.
No thanks, Tootsie.
Why not?
Well, you see, I'd rather work in a home where there's babies. You see, I just love to bathe babies with Swan.
Well, Bill...
You know, Swan is so pure, it's kind to even a baby's tender skin. And if it's swell for baby, well, it's great for your hands and face, your tub or shower.
Well, Bill...
You know, many women have long considered Castile soap's the standard of purity.
Well, Bill...
But Swan is even purer than the finest Castile.
Well, Bill... Well... Bill, I have an idea. I'll come over and cook for you.
Oh, no, Tootsie. You see, I don't have any pots or pans.
Well, that's all right. I bring my pans.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Well, Bill, Tootsie's a wonderful cook. Just look at this stew we're making for George. There. Get a whiff of that.
Say, you girls are going to be famous.
Really?
Why, sure, you've got a new formula for synthetic rubber. Goodbye.
Did you hear what he called our stew?
He doesn't know what he's talking about. It might look like rubber and smell like rubber and stretch like rubber, but who ever saw rubber with bananas in it?
Oh, Gracie. Where are you?
Oh, my goodness, George is back. He mustn't find me here.
Well, don't worry, I'll keep him out of the kitchen. Oh, hello, dear. Back so soon?
Yeah. I went to 12 employment agencies. 11 of them are out of business, and the other one's a bookie.
Oh, well, cheer up, darling. While you were gone, I got a cook.
You did? Where'd you get her?
Where?
Yeah.
Oh, I got her from the Bayliss's across the street.
Well, why did they give her up?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, they went away for a rest. Yeah, that's it. They went away for a rest. To Europe.
They went to Europe for a rest?
Well, you see, he used to live in New York under the elevated, and he can't rest unless there's a lot of noise, so...
Gracie, I'd like to see this cook.
Oh, well, no, you can't, George. She's very temperamental. She's scared of men.
She's scared of men.
Well, yeah, you see, her mother was once frightened by her father, who was a man. And ever since...
Gracie, I'm going in to see this cook.
No, wait, George. She's very temperamental.
But I want to talk to her. What's her name?
Her name?
Yeah.
Oh, it's, Bridget. Oh, I'll tell you what, George. Talk to her through the kitchen door.
For what? I'm going in there.
Oh, no, you're not. Gracie,
what's the thing?
Lock the door.
Let me in there. Let me in.
George, Bridget doesn't want you in here, do you, Bridget? Her faith in that I don't. I'll have no man tracking up me wife's kitchen with his big feet.
Was that Bridget who just spoke?
Well, of course it was, George. She's Irish. Aren't you, Bridget? Sure in that I am.
Bridget, are you sure you're not Gracie?
Oh, ho, ho. Go away with you now. Faith and Gracie is 10 times prettier than I am. And it's lucky you are to be married to a Colleen whose eyes are as blue as the lakes of Killarney and whose fur coat is getting a little tattered, so why don't you buy her a new one?
Well, now I'm convinced you're not Gracie. But, you know, but from the sound of your voice, Bridget, me darling, I'll bet you're every bit as pretty.
George Burns, you stop flirting with me.
What did you say?
Faith and I mean you stop flirting with your wife.
Enough is enough. Unlock this door.
Gracie, I think the stew is ready. It just collapsed.
Oh, good. I'm coming right out, dear. Dinner is ready. Well, here you are. Just tuck your napkin around your neck.
Does that smell come from this food?
Yes. Doesn't it smell delicious? Bridget says it's an old family recipe. This stew has been handed down from mother to daughter.
Looks like one of them dropped it. Look, Bridget, I heard you whispering to somebody in... Which one of your club members is out there in the kitchen?
Why, George Burns,
I'll be right back. I see. Tootsie!
Oh, hello, George. My, you look handsome today. New suit. Well, goodbye.
Tootsie, you come in here.
Yes, George?
Sit down and eat that stew.
Well, I'd love to, but I'm really not hungry. I had a glass of water this morning.
Eat it!
Well, go on, Tootsie. Tootsie, eat him. And when he sees how much you enjoyed, he'll adopt our club plan.
Yeah.
Here, open your mouth and swallow this.
Oh.
Well, how do you like it? Well, don't just pop your eyes at me, Tootsie. How do you like it?
It's delicious. Goodbye.
Well, that's good. That is great. Simply a wonderful idea. Now, there's no dinner, and I'm starved.
Well, here's where our boost in the crisis plan goes to work. I'll just call Blanche Morton, and she'll come over and cook our dinner.
Well, tell her to hurry. Is she a good cook?
Good. She taught Tootsie Sagwell everything she knows.
Never mind. We'll eat out. That's all.
George and Gracie will be right back, so I'm going to make a brief suggestion. Instead of buying lots of different kinds of soaps, try Swan for every soap and water job in the house. In the kitchen, Swan does the work of easy-to-waste package soaps. And in the bathroom, for your hands and face, Swan gives you as pure a soap as money can buy. And at the same time, gives you more soap per penny than any leading toilet soap tested. So be kind to your budget, and be kind to your hands with Swan, the soap that's purer than the finest Castile. Well, here they are again, George and Gracie.
Well, George, our stew might have looked and tasted like synthetic rubber, but I got a pound of waste fat out of it, and I took it down to the butcher's.
Well.
The government can use it to make bombs and bullets.
Good. And what did you do with the rest of the stew?
Oh. How do you like my new galoshes?
The makers of Swan, the new white floating soap, join George and Gracie in inviting you to tune in to your CBS station again next week, same time, when their guest will be Charles Lawton. Remember, George Burns and Gracie Allen, CBS next Tuesday night. And don't forget to listen to Swan's other comedy show, Tommy Riggs and Betty Lou, over another network every Friday night. And now till next week, this is Bill Goodwin saying, well, I, Swan, how about you?
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
George Burns and Gracie Allen. And a slight slip of the tongue from yours truly as I was introducing this program. I said that it was an NBC broadcast. In fact, it was not. It was a CBS broadcast, as we just heard. Burns and Allen had done quite a bit of work for NBC prior to this particular series on Columbia. Originally airing February 2nd, 1943, Good Help is Hard to Find. And with that, we come to the end of this hour of Old Time Radio. I'm Jake Longwell. Once again, if you want to get in touch with the show, it's qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And the blog and website for more info and streaming audio, qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. Do join me again soon, won't you, for another hour of sounds from radio's golden age. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.